From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today on Fresh Air, Passion in Paradise. My guests are journalist Stephen Kinzer and anthropologist Richard Parker. In 1977, freelancer Stephen Kinzer set out for Nicaragua. He stayed to see the Sandinistas overthrow the Somoza dictatorship and then signed on with the New York Times to cover the Contra War. Along the way, Kinzer fell in love with the tropical land of the poets. It was Rio de Janeiro that drew anthropologist Richard Parker to Brazil, where he became fascinated by the intricate world of female and transvestite prostitutes outside his hotel. Before he knew it, he was seduced by the complex world of Brazilian sexuality. All that and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The tide of labor unrest in the Soviet Union appeared to subside a bit today. Workers in the Soviet Republic of Belarus suspended a three-day-old strike, and some coal miners agreed to return to work. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The Belarusian strikers said they would suspend their economic and political protest until May 21st, when the Republic's parliament meets. Meanwhile, strike representatives say that coal miners in the Arctic Circle region of Vorkuta are returning to work at all but two of the region's 14 mines. But in the country's two largest coal regions, miners remain on strike, demanding the resignations of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and his government. The miners have rejected a back-to-work appeal from Gorbachev and the leaders of nine Soviet republics, including Russia's leader Boris Yeltsin. Russian trade union leaders had called for a one-hour work stoppage across the republic today to press for greater pay and economic benefits, but their call failed to draw widespread support. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Today marks the fifth anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear accident. Former Olympic gold medalist Olga Korbut, who comes from the Belarusian city of Minsk, warned that the entire republic is still threatened by the long-term effects of the accident. Korbut told a group of environmentalists in Washington that thousands of people have died or will die of radiation-related cancers. The former Soviet gymnast said that the republic's hospitals don't have the facilities to deal with radiation illnesses. She also said that more than half of Belarus's rich farmland can no longer be planted. Polish opposition leaders today vowed to block the Catholic Church's efforts to make Catholicism the country's official religion. Polish bishops have submitted a proposal calling for an end to the separation of church and state in the country's new constitution. Gabriel Glazer reports from Warsaw.
Leaders of the Committee to Redraft the Constitution said today the bishop's proposal was a throwback to the 18th century. Jerzy Rusecki, who heads the parliamentary committee, said he saw no reason whatsoever why a modern Poland should become a theocratic state. But the church is wielding a heavy hand in the new Poland. Last year, it established religion classes in the public schools and prompted tighter restrictions on divorce. And the parliament is moving towards a vote on a bill that would outlaw all abortions, the chief form of birth control here, and imprison the doctors who perform them for up to 2 years. The vote is expected next month. For National Public Radio, this is Gabrielle Glazer in Warsaw.
Stock prices were down today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 9 points to close at 2,912.38. Declines led advances by 4-3. This is NPR News. Procter & Gamble Company agreed today to remove the word fresh from its Citrus Hill Fresh Choice label orange juice. The Food and Drug Administration demanded the change because the Citrus Hill product is actually made from concentrate. Yesterday, federal prosecutors raided a warehouse in Minneapolis and seized 12,000 gallons of the juice on the grounds that it was mislabeled. Burroughs Wellcome Company announced today that it plans to resume selling its Sudafed 12-hour cold medication a month after two people were fatally poisoned by tainted Sudafed capsules. From member station WUNC, Adam Hochberg reports.
Burroughs Wellcome officials say they are returning the medication to the market only in tablet form. Sudafed 12-hour cold medication in capsule form has been blamed for three poisonings in Washington state, two of them fatal. The capsules were tainted with cyanide, but Burroughs Wellcome spokeswoman Sharon Haggerty says there's less risk of that happening with the new tablet product.
History tells us that tablets have not been tampered with in the past. However, it's important to remember that no product is tamper-proof.
Haggerty says the Sudafed tablets, like the capsules, will be packaged in a tamper-proof blister pack, and she says consumers should make sure the foil backing on the pack is intact before they take the medication. Burroughs Wellcome will continue to sell other drugs in capsule form, such as its popular cold and allergy medication, Actifed. No arrests have been made in the Sudafed tampering case. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Residents of the northern Iraqi town of Zako say secret police loyal to Saddam Hussein have replaced the uniformed security forces who left the town yesterday. The Iraqi security forces were withdrawn under an ultimatum from U.S., British, and French commanders who want to resettle Kurdish refugees in camps near Zako. Today, residents of Zako say that Iraqi secret police in civilian clothes are patrolling the town and creating an atmosphere of tension. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. For an entire decade, the United States government seemed possessed with the fate of one small nation that divided the Atlantic from the Pacific, Nicaragua. In 1977, a young freelancer named Stephen Kinzer got a press card from Tiny Pacific News Service and caught a plane for Nicaragua. By 1983, he had been hired by the New York Times. Last year, he finally left. Now, with the revolutionary Sandinistas out of power, Nicaragua has all but vanished from the North American horizon. In a remarkably detailed personal account, Kinzer has written about his 13-year love affair with Nicaragua. He calls it Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You say you're trying to bring Americans to some understanding of the people who live and make up Nicaragua. But you also seem to be coming to terms with yourself as a young man who would be a great journalist in a country that has a long history with the United States.
It was obviously a difficult situation to be an American reporting from a country where the United States was sponsoring a war. But the Nicaraguans welcomed me, and I think sometimes I was actually surprised at how little hostility they seemed to show to individual Americans. They opened themselves up in a way that many people in the United States and more sophisticated or developed countries never do. I felt a warmth and a love from Nicaraguans that I felt in very few other places I've ever visited. This is something else I try to bring across in my book, that the ordinary Nicaraguan had a story to tell, which was never told in the United States. We were always told that Nicaragua was under the rule of a brutal, cruel government, or if you were listening to the other side, that they were under the rule of humanistic socialists. But we were never brought beyond the political debate. When you are reporting on a war from Washington, as many people did during the Nicaraguan War, you see it only as a conflict of ideologies and a political conflict. What I'm trying to do in my book is not make a final judgment about who was right and who was wrong, but rather to help people understand the motivations that all the different factions and all the different leaders were feeling. It's not an attempt to reach a judgment. It's an attempt to help people understand.
You attempt to avoid, as you say, casting judgments on the politics of the country, but it's pretty clear that the Somoza dynasty was pretty abhorrent to you.
The Somoza dictatorship was cruel and brutal. The most...
You call him, or you quote someone else as describing Anastasio Somoza as a combination of Caligula and Dale Carnegie.
He had managed to persuade the government of the United States that it was all right to support his dictatorship because he was a friend of the United States and that he could maintain a country under his thumb and make sure that the United States always had a reliable ally there. That was really all that Washington was interested in. But those of us who had a chance to visit Nicaragua during the time Somoza was in power, and unfortunately there were very few American journalists who did that, saw another side of the Somoza dictatorship. Not only was he a cruel dictator, but he was a person devoted fanatically to his own personal gain. The Somoza family, during 40 years of ruling Nicaragua, stole everything they could get their hands on. The Somoza family became the wealthiest family in Nicaraguan history, and thereby earned the opprobrium of their entire nation. At the time when the Sandinistas began their first major offensive against the Somozas in the late 1970s, virtually the entire population was ready to join any movement that was going to oust the dictatorship. And it was really the cruelty and the brutality and the corruption of the Somoza dictatorship that created the conditions that permitted the Sandinistas to come to power.
And the Sandinistas are problematical for a lot of Americans. Certainly on the left, people wanted to see them as heroes, not only in Nicaragua, but for all of Latin America, sort of throwing off this this decrepit history. How did you come to see Sandinismo?
At the beginning, naturally, the anti-American aspect of the Sandinista front was very understandable. The United States had played an ignoble role in Nicaragua over many decades. It was natural that a movement that was rebelling against the dictatorship, a dictatorship that was supported by the United States, would be anti-American. Nonetheless, when the Sandinistas came to power, they were supported by a wide range of civilian groups. They were supported by political parties, by trade unions, even by business organizations. It seemed that they were part of a broad coalition. But as the months passed after they came to power, we came to see that wasn't true. The five-member junta that the Sandinistas established to run Nicaragua soon realized that it really didn't have any power at all. And therefore, the junta split. Two of its members quit and became vituperatively anti-Sandinista. One of them, in fact, went on to become president of Nicaragua today. That's Violeta Chamorro. The problem is not that the Sandinistas took up arms rather than trying to come to power by peaceful means. The problem was what happened after they came to power. They had destroyed the machinery of the dictatorship, but then, instead of trying to build a broad-based government, they fell back on their own ideology and therefore limited, really, the amount that they were able to do for Nicaragua.
Why do you think that was so? What was the appeal of revolutionary Marxism for these mostly men, young men, highly educated, from the upper classes in Nicaragua? Why do you think that that happened?
There are several reasons. First of all, the concept of democracy became polluted in Nicaragua, as in much of Latin America. The Somoza dictatorship, like many other dictatorships in Latin America, cloaked itself in the rhetoric of democracy. They wrapped themselves in the American flag, and they held regular elections all the time, and they maintained what seemed to be a democratic structure on the surface. Everyone who lived there, however, could see that this was a phony democracy and that these elections never meant anything. They were only tools by which the dictatorship maintained its power. Therefore, revolutionaries in Nicaragua became very soured on the idea of democracy, on the idea of elections. They had seen these ideas used as ways to prop up a dictatorship, and they were looking for alternatives to that. Another factor had to do with their admiration for Fidel Castro. Castro had led the only successful revolution in Latin America up until the time the Sandinistas took over. During the entire 20 years that the Sandinistas were fighting for power, Castro was their hero. And when they came to power, they sought to duplicate Cuba. They sought to build a regime and a government and a society in Nicaragua that would approximate what Castro had done in Cuba. Finally,
That so unreasonable given what they could look around Central America and see on these sort of basic bread and butter issues of housing and health and literacy and all of that? Is it so surprising that Cuba would seem appealing?
Cuba had much to offer in the way of an example to Nicaragua. However, the errors of the Cuban government and the insistence of the Cuban leadership in maintaining the country under a single ideological rule was something that was really not applicable to Nicaragua. I always felt that the Sandinistas were not revolutionary enough, if you want to put it in these terms, that the kind of government they installed in Nicaragua was not a radical enough departure from that of the old dictatorship. They believed that they knew what was best for Nicaragua. They believed that all of their enemies were traitors, and they believed that their ideology was the one that held the key to Nicaragua's progress. This was what ruling groups in Latin America had believed for centuries. It would have been more revolutionary for the Sandinistas to break with the pattern of Castro, to break with the pattern of regimes both of the left and of the right, and to try to introduce a fully open and fully pluralistic society in Nicaragua. They never went that far. They provided the basis for the emergence of a regime that did go that far, but they themselves, I think, were trapped in an ideology that emerged in the late 1950s and early 1960s and were never successful in modernizing it to adapt it to the Nicaragua of the 1980s.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, New York Times reporter who spent many years in Nicaragua and has written a new book called The Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Kinzer is my guest. He spent more than a decade in Nicaragua watching the revolution against the Somoza dictatorship and what he sees as the steady souring of the Sandinista promise. You talk in the book about the relations between the Sandinistas and the Miskito Indians, and you tell a story of a child who seemed to have been killed and came back to life almost. Can you tell us what that is and what that might tell us about Sandinista Nicaragua?
The Miskito Indians and the way the Miskito Indians were treated by the Sandinistas was an area that particularly interested me. I spent a lot of time in the Miskito Indian homeland and came to develop a special affection for the Miskitos. They suffered particularly from the arrogance of the Sandinistas. Like almost all Spanish-speaking Nicaraguans, the Sandinistas knew nothing about the Miskito Indians. The Indians had lived in a part of Nicaragua for centuries that was completely cut off from the mainstream of Nicaraguan life and had developed patterns of life very different from those of Spanish-speaking Nicaraguans. The Sandinistas, however, arrived there with no understanding of this culture, this rich history of and rich tradition, and tried to impose their style of rule on people who had a very different view of life. It was odd because in some ways the Miskitos were living in a form of true communism in a primitive sense. They farmed on communal lands and shared most of their properties. But this wasn't good enough for the Sandinistas. They insisted on telling the Miskito Indians, just like they told people in other parts of Nicaragua, what crops they should grow, who they should sell them to, how much money they should charge for them, where they should fish, where they should hunt. And naturally, the Indians bridled at these efforts. The Miskito Rebellion and the vigor with which the Sandinistas moved to suppress it aroused the conscience of the world and wound up, in my judgment, being one of the greatest mistakes the Sandinistas made. They failed to appreciate the culture and identity of Nicaraguan Indians and inflicted on them the greatest trauma in their tribal history.
Well, you were somewhat baffled and intrigued as well by these cultural rituals. There was this incident that seemed to be an almost like a mystical curing, except it didn't make sense.
I open the chapter in my book about the Miskito Indians by describing a strange incident that I never was really able to understand. I arrived in a tiny little Miskito Indian village and suddenly heard a shrieking mother running up from the riverbank with what seemed to be a dead child in her hands, in her arms. It turned out that this child had been bitten, apparently by an insect, and the whole side of the child's face was swollen up, and the child was totally lifeless to all appearances. The mother was completely distraught. Other villagers gathered around in horror. There, of course, was nothing even resembling medical care in a remote village like this, and nobody knew what to do, including me. Suddenly, a young woman emerged from the crowd of villagers and went over to this child, kneeled down over him, and began chanting in strange syllables that were not Spanish and were also not the Miskito language. Then she produced flower petals from inside one of her pockets and began sprinkling these petals over the baby. And she was chanting as if she was trying to coax some kind of evil spirit out of that baby's body. This went on for 10 or 15 minutes. She slapped the baby a few times on its chest, sprinkled more flower petals, and chanted more. Everybody held their breath and wondered what was going on. And then suddenly, to our astonishment, the baby opened his eyes and started to cry. And the mother, who had been sobbing in anguish over what she thought was the death of her child, shrieked for joy, grabbed the baby, and everybody that was watching was stunned. None of us could understand how this had happened. Later on, I went over to this woman and asked her if she was some kind of a healer or if she was some kind of a mystic who had learned some ancient traditions or some ancient rituals from forebearers. She just laughed and said, "Oh, no, I'm no healer. I'm no mystic. I don't really know anything about what just happened. I can't explain it myself, but I was in a refugee camp for several years, and I saw some people there who were healers, and they chanted, and they used these flower petals, so I thought maybe I could do the same thing, and sure enough, it worked." Later on, I tried to understand what had happened and how that had worked, and I never was able to figure it out.
Has that incident produced a certain amount of at least caution in your faith in conventional explanations of how the world works?
Certainly when you work in Latin America, particularly in Nicaragua, you find that there is no single truth. There is no answer to every question. There's a great tendency, particularly on the part of Americans, to want to find out quickly who's right, who's wrong, who's telling the truth, who's lying, and what the real explanation is. That is a cultural bias that slowly I had to lose in my years in Nicaragua. I had to understand that people who were arguing with each other might both be right. And it was a difficult thing, I think, for an American to assimilate. I think it was more important for journalists who were covering Nicaragua to help Americans understand this country than it was for us to try to tell Americans very specifically who was right and who was wrong.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Stephen Kinzer, New York Times reporter, whose new book is called The Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. I was struck by something fairly early on in your book about the press. We have this notion that all of the media are fiercely competitive with one another, jealous of their sources, don't give over facts. And yet, at one point, you were living in a house with a reporter from Time, another from the Washington Post, another from the New York Times, the Washington Star, and the Journal du Brasil. And you almost, it sounds as though you almost set up a kind of a press bureau and you gave each other assignments, and at the end of the day you sort of corroborated each other's stories, and then you filed your pieces. This is surely not what we tend to think as the way it's done.
Journalists have to adapt to circumstances, particularly when they're working abroad. The period that you're talking about was the period of the Sandinista uprising. We had a war going on all over Nicaragua. It was impossible to think that one person could find out each day the major events that had taken place in the war and then write a story about that. Each of us, at best, was able only to see the smallest piece of what was happening. I was living in a house at that time with a group of other reporters, and we agreed among ourselves to divide up our tasks. One would go and try to find out what the National Guard and the forces of the dictatorship were planning. Another would try to find Sandinistas and see what they were planning. someone else would go out and travel to different towns outside of Managua and see if we could find out the progress of the war on the ground. It was only this way that we were able to piece together a possibly accurate view of what was happening. There is a danger, of course, that when reporters are sitting around the table together every night, they begin to think that what they say to each other is more important than what they hear from people out in the street. That's a danger to guard against, and that's the reason why, during my years in Nicaragua, I spent most of my time in my Jeep roaming around the countryside and trying to meet the people who were really being most affected by both the Sandinista government policies and the Contra War. It was those people who were really the basis of my reporting, and while I was always anxious to be in contact with other reporters and to measure my observations against theirs, I never lost sight of the fact that it was the ordinary poor Nicaraguans who really had the story to tell.
When Violeta Chamorro came to this country in the winter and spoke to Congress, Senator Jesse Helms, probably the most vocal, one of the most vocal spokesmen for the Contras, didn't even show up.
I find it very distressing to see how quickly the United States has turned its back on Nicaragua. We are responsible for the destruction of the Nicaraguan economy. Whether or not one supported the Contras, one can now say that we spent hundreds of millions of dollars in a war aimed specifically at burning farms and blowing up factories and crippling the Nicaraguan economy. Now we have finally achieved the result that we hoped for. We have a pro-American, pro-capitalist government in Nicaragua. Yet we are refusing to give it the aid that it needs to solidify itself. This is particularly upsetting because Mrs. Chamorro, for the first time, is trying to build a broad-based government in Nicaragua, something that has never been done before. In Nicaragua, it has always been traditional that the group in power monopolizes 100% of the power and the others get zero. And the only way to come back to power is to rebel. Mrs. Chamorro is trying to break with that pattern by inviting some Sandinistas into her government and consulting with Sandinistas as she rules. It's extremely upsetting now to see officials in Washington trying to tell her, you shouldn't be doing that, and trying to withhold, essentially, aid for her because they don't approve of the details of the way she's governing. This is just what the United States has been doing in Nicaragua for this whole century, trying to govern Nicaragua itself and replace the judgment of its own leaders with our judgment. We have now a situation in Nicaragua where there's a tremendous amount of political freedom, but there is great economic difficulty that threatens all the political progress that's been made there.
I want to thank you for being with us, Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is the author of Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, filling in for Terry Gross. Mention Brazil to most people, and they conjure up images of Rio de Janeiro's carnival and tales of sexual abandon. My guest, anthropologist Richard Parker, had his own preconceptions about Brazil when he arrived in 1982 to do field work there. Coming up, Richard Parker tells us almost everything you always wanted to know about sex in Brazil. Also, we hear about the uncensored, recut version of the 1960 epic Spartacus from film critic Stephen Schiff. In it, Laurence Olivier portrays a Roman general who tries to seduce a sensitive slave boy played by Tony Curtis. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Iraq has announced that it is disbanding its militia called the Popular Army. The Iraqi news agency carried the announcement and said the ruling Revolutionary Command Council made that decision today. The Popular Army, formed before Iraq's 8-year war with Iran in the 1980s, was originally made up of 1 million soldiers. It draws its strength from 16- and 17-year-old young men and men over the age of 45. There's a small symbolic force of women. UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar said today that the UN could begin taking over refugee camps in northern Iraq within days. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Pérez de Cuellar said he was sending two of his aides to Geneva to discuss plans to take over the refugee camps in northern Iraq. The camps were set up by the U.S., France, and Britain and are patrolled by Allied military forces. Allied officials have said repeatedly that they want the U.N. to assume control of the camps, and Pérez de Cuellar said the takeover was imminent.
We are going to replace the United Nations, the United States, France, and the British presence there, in a very quiet manner with our civilian staff.
But some UN officials say a complete takeover is still far off. They say big questions remain about how to protect the Kurds once the Allied troops leave. One solution, they say, is to send UN relief workers to the area in large numbers, but to delay a formal takeover until the troops leave. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The UN says it will investigate border incidents between Iran and Iraq and will open offices in the capitals of those countries to look into the matter. Javier Pérez de Cuellar says the offices in Baghdad and Tehran will be staffed with both civilian personnel and military observers. President Bush again today defended his chief of staff, John Sununu, in the face of criticism surrounding his use of military jets for political and personal use. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
President Bush has ordered White House counsel Boyden Gray to review the government policy that allows senior presidential aides to always travel aboard Air Force planes. Records released this week show that Governor Sununu used military jets more than 70 times since 1989, including trips to ski and to visit his dentist. Despite his promise to review the policy, President Bush also defended his chief of staff.
John Sununu acted in accordance with existing policy. But if there's reason to change it, I'll be out there in the front making some suggested changes.
Aides say that despite published reports to the contrary, Sununu is not in trouble with the president. Nevertheless, Mr. Bush said today he wants his administration to continue to be above the perception of impropriety. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrials fell almost 9 points to 2912.39. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-3 in moderate trading of 154 million shares. This is NPR News. German environmental authorities say that hundreds of playgrounds, sports fields, and schoolyards are covered with red paving that contains hazardous dioxin. The environmental minister for the North Rhine-Westphalia state says the contamination came from refuse in a copper refinery. It was turned into red gravel and distributed widely for use in paving material. The dioxin levels were discovered a week ago. The first test showed that the levels of the substance were 700 times the limit set by the Federal Health Ministry for sports grounds. A private environmental group has called on the government to test all playgrounds for dioxin and to close the ones deemed hazardous. A London-based charitable foundation has issued a new report saying that the famine now threatening parts of sub-Saharan Africa is worse than that seen in the mid-1980s. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
Save the Children says that as many as 27 million people in Africa are now facing severe food shortages and that more than half of them are children. The organization's Africa director, Mark Bowden, says he's concerned that the plight of the African famine victims will be forgotten because of the Kurdish refugee crisis.
In 1985, there were 12 million tons of food aid available worldwide to deal with the emergency. This year, we're going into a situation with only 9 million tons of food aid available. So there does need to be an extraordinary political response to unlock food surpluses and get them into areas of need straight away.
This latest report is also aimed at dispelling some of the myths concerning famine. It says it's not the case that third world countries struck by food shortages overspend on military, or that famine is caused by overpopulation. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
It was 5 years ago today that the number 4 reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant exploded. Soviet officials say the scope of the catastrophe is just becoming apparent and that millions of people affected by radiation are still fighting for better care. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has published an appeal for help internationally. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. South of the equator, so the saying goes, there is no sin. When anthropologist Richard Parker first went to Brazil, he supposed he'd find a village somewhere along the Amazon, watch the natives, and write about them. But pretty soon, he found himself in Rio, and he realized that sex and the city were far more compelling topics, both personally and professionally, than Aboriginal life in the forest. 10 years later, Parker still lives in Rio, and he's published his first book about sexuality in Brazil. It's called Bodies, Pleasures, and Passions. And in it, he argues that sexuality, even what's gay and what's straight, is not the same the world over.
In popular culture in Brazil, and for men and women from the popular classes, the very category of homosexual and heterosexual, those categories don't even really exist. They're medical scientific categories that the educated elite may use, but that are very rarely used by people from the popular sectors.
So tell me how these labels work out. I mean, if it's not homosexual, heterosexual, what is it?
Well, a man who performs the active role in sex with another man...
The man who's the penetrator.
Exactly. Doesn't necessarily consider himself to be any different from any other man. He's performing his typical male role. He's being active just like he would in sexual relations with a woman, right? And the culture doesn't classify or label him as being different because of that behavior. Now, on the contrary, a man who performs the passive role, who is penetrated, is labeled with a number of distinct, highly stigmatized terms.
Terms like what?
In Brazilian Portuguese, bicho or viado are the most common terms in Rio, for example. But the specific terms will
vary.
And
what would those words mean in English?
Oh, probably the best way to translate would be queer or faggot, stigmatizing labels that we also have in the United States. But the thing that's interesting there is that label would only be applied to the passive individual in the relationship. An active man wouldn't be stigmatized as a bicha. He's just being an omen, a man.
A guy.
A guy, exactly. And not only that, but a particularly macho guy, because the sign of being macho is having sex with as many people, conquering as many people as you possibly can. It's very much a kind of power question, and the notion of conquering, making a conquest, is typically part of that dynamic.
But you wouldn't be called gay or homosexual,
in
that light. And but how extensive are we really talking about? Simply a few people in the city, or are we talking about a really common and widespread phenomenon in Brazilian?
No,
life?
I think we're talking about a really common or widespread phenomenon. And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned you wouldn't be called gay, for example, and that's true. It's interesting the way the term gay comes into Brazilian culture. It's imported in from the United States, from North America. But it applies only to extremely effeminate and therefore presumably passive individuals. The people who are most commonly called gay in Brazilian society are the transvestites who adopt an extremely exaggerated performance of femininity.
Transvestites in Brazil are really a bit different than transvestites in the United States, aren't they? I mean, I remember talking to another anthropologist several years ago, and he said, you know, you really can't tell a really good transvestite in Brazil from a beautiful woman, and that's, there's a very special role. And there are a lot of transvestites there, you seem to be seeing.
Yeah, it's quite an impressive phenomenon, actually. Transvestism is quite widespread. Anyone who spends any amount of time in large Brazilian cities like Rio or São Paulo will certainly come across, particularly in the evening hours, transvestites whose performances are extremely well done in comparison with transvestites anywhere else in the world that I can think of. It's very elaborate, and in making the change from one gender to another, a number of things are done that I think are more is more intense in Brazil than anywhere I can think of. For example, along with using hormone treatments to change gender, a great deal is done with silicone injections, very, very well done. The fact that Brazil is the one of the great capitals of plastic surgery and transforming the body generally, I think, is all part of the same complex. And the transformation of the body that transvestites undergo in Brazil is really a very impressive thing to see. You know, I live in Copacabana, very near a part of the beach that the transvestites like to frequent. And so during time, you often can see the transformation happening right before your eyes. A young boy will appear near that part of the beach, you know, at the start of the summer, and you will reappear on and off over the course of a year, sometimes more. And suddenly, you can see the hormone treatment starting to be taken, the silicone starting to be injected gradually over time, so that suddenly a year has passed and the young boy has transformed into a young woman. And that process goes on with aging, and a whole series of transformations happens right before your eyes.
Well, a lot of people, probably most people listening, don't have too much experience of transvestites, but there's something else that goes on in Brazil, and it's not simply those people who go through the transformations. But in some sense, during Carnival, the season just at the end of Lent, the season in February, the great 4-day party in February, all sorts of people dress in the other sex's clothes. Men wear dresses, and as do women, and their wives often make the dresses for them, and they're not transvestites. So there's something going on. There's what is the word for the clothing you talk about? The fantasia. The clothing itself is called a fantasy, isn't it?
The clothing itself is called a fantasy, and at some level, Carnival is clearly a kind of 4-day cultural fantasy in which the entire society tends to reinvent itself, at least during a given period. It's a kind of ritual of transformation in which it's possible at least for a few days to live out one's fantasies. So the transformations take place in all sorts of ways. Men become women, as you say. The poor become well-to-do. One of the most common images in the samba school parades that are a real focus for the carnival in Rio de Janeiro is for the poorest members of Brazilian society to adopt the fantasias or costumes of extremely well-to-do nobles or rulers from the days of the colony, for example. So everybody transforms themselves at some level. And thinking particularly of transvestism, it's very interesting because there are many different kinds of transvestism or cross-dressing during Carnival. You've got, as you say, men who were, you know, in daily life just kind of average Joes, whose wives help them make their costume, and often it's a very exaggerated, funny kind of vision of femininity with comic breasts and playful images of women as housemaids or what have you. At the same time, you've also got the transvestites who are in fact transvestites in normal daily life, but who use Carnival as an opportunity to take their vision of transvestism to an extreme with much more elaborate costumes of Hollywood vamps and the like.
My guest is Richard Parker. He's an anthropologist who's been living in Brazil. His new book on the sexual culture of Brazil is called Bodies, Pleasures, and Passions. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Parker is my guest. He has lived in Brazil for about a decade and has written a new book called Bodies, Pleasures, and Passions about sexual life in Brazil. Does all of the sexual possibility mean that sexual life is free or freer, that there's no stigma in Brazil, that you can be anything you want and everybody celebrates it and is happy?
No, it definitely doesn't. One of the things that the book really tries to do is look at the contradictions, at the fact that at the very same time that you can have a macho society, a very patriarchal society with a deeply ingrained Catholic ideology that, like other religions, views sexuality with its own particular vision and stigmatizes many expressions of sexuality, at the same time that you have these kinds of conservative views, conservative tendencies, regulating and controlling sexuality, at the same time that that exists, you have this other current that we talked about earlier, a kind of celebration of sensuality as a positive value, okay? And what I think is interesting and important to try and understand, and also difficult to understand, is the fact that these things can exist at the same time, and that people live with those kinds of contradictions in their lives and have to negotiate and navigate their way between such conflicting values.
You've done a lot of work with AIDS since you've been in Brazil, and in a way it might not seem so surprising that a country that has such complex sexuality and frankly so much sex, that AIDS, it doesn't seem so surprising AIDS would become a big issue. How does the way in which Brazil deals with AIDS differ from what you see in the North?
On the basis of some of the issues that we've already talked about, it comes as no surprise that the AIDS epidemic in Brazil has been severe, that it continues to be very explosive, and that many of the particular characteristics of Brazilian sexual culture are important in trying to understand the way AIDS has manifested itself in Brazil, as well as the ways in which Brazilian society might try to respond to it. I mean, we've already talked, for example, about the fact that many men who have sex with men don't consider themselves to be gay or homosexual. That's clearly very important in looking at the way that the epidemic has spread, as well as in the way that Brazilian society can respond to it. The earliest cases of AIDS in Brazil were almost all reported in behaviorally homosexual men who had been infected often during periods abroad in the early 1980s. But very rapidly, as AIDS came home to Brazilian soil, if you will, and as HIV transmission began to take place in Brazil itself, the notion of distinct risk groups broke down.
You mean because people don't live or don't stay in the same sexual category, that you can't separate gay from straight? I mean, I remember I spoke to another person who lived a long time in Brazil, and he said, you know, God knows if there is a heterosexual population in Brazil.
There's a lot of space for fluidity, certainly, and not only for fluidity in terms of bisexual behavior, but also for a fair amount of a change of partners and multiple partners on the part of individuals who are behaviorally heterosexual. So that in a variety of ways, the sexual culture opens up opportunities for HIV transmission that have been very important in the way the epidemic has taken shape there.
Have these sexual behaviors also made a difference in how the country has tried to fight the disease, either in terms of prevention or care or education?
I think they have. On the one hand, clearly, in my opinion, Brazilians at every level, and here I think that you can say this is true of the government as well as civil society, have approached AIDS with less inhibition and less puritanism than has been true, for example, in North America, I think.
There's an interesting program educating construction workers about how to have safe sex while they're away from home. And as I understand it, the program has illustrations and videos showing them how to have sex with men and how to have sex with women so that they don't transmit the disease. Is this true?
Indeed, it's true. That program is one that was developed by the Brazilian Interdisciplinary AIDS Association, BIA for short. And BIA, like many of the other NGOs, have developed highly targeted and very innovative AIDS education materials for a number of social groups. Again, the tendency is to not target what we think of as the traditional risk groups, gay men or IV drug users, but to target socially relevant populations like construction workers, civil construction workers who are often migrants who are away from home and the traditional family atmosphere and who may engage in sexual relations with female prostitutes or with others on the construction, other men on the construction site. They also target groups like street children, who have a whole set of risk factors, if you will, by virtue of their particular situation. So
you mean they use drugs and they're prostitutes?
They use drugs. They may prostitute. They may have sex between one another, both same-sex and opposite-sex relationships. So there are a variety of questions at issue there. And the population, as you'll see from talking about all of those different risk behaviors, you can't identify them just on the basis of one particular risk activity. So you focus on the population as a significant social population, street kids rather than IV drug users, for example. And that's one way of developing innovative AIDS education materials in Brazil that I think has been particularly effective and needs to be explored more fully.
My guest has been Richard Parker. He's the author of a new book on sexual culture in Brazil. It's called Bodies, Pleasures, and Passions. He also has lived in Brazil for the last 10 years. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us from All Things Considered. What's in the news today, Robert?
Well, news today that President Bush says the U.S. presence in northern Iraq to protect Kurdish refugees there is open-ended. And it seems that the uniformed Iraqis have left the town of Zaqo, around which camps are being established, but there may be some ununiformed secret police still there. On other fronts, a strike by Belarusians in Minsk is over. We'll recall the disaster at Chernobyl 5 years later. Also, a story about a production of Julius Caesar that's being launched on the vacant top floor of an office building in Northern Virginia, and a story about whether the free trade agreement with Mexico will mean more pollution across the border.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and others coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When the 1960 film Spartacus was released, several scenes were cut by censors. In one of them, a master asks his slave boy about his taste and appetite for both oysters and snails, intimating something about sexual preference. The censors thought seafood was too suggestive and wanted it to be replaced with artichokes and truffles. When the filmmakers refused the changes, the scene was out. Now the film's been restored, oysters, snails, and all, by Richard Harris, the man who restored Lawrence of Arabia. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Coming between the opulent re-releases of two great movies, Lawrence of Arabia and Citizen Kane, the restoration of Spartacus looks a little out of place. Spartacus may have been the best of the old sword and sandals epics, but it still creaks along as campily as the most muscle-bound Victor Mature blunderbuss. Stanley Kubrick, of all people, directed it when he was 31, and in a way the movie reflects the split that was developing in his own sensibility. Kubrick was a kid from the Bronx, but he had a mile-wide streak of Anglophilia, and in fact, a year after Spartacus was released, he moved to England for good. So it's not surprising that the movie is divided between American earnestness and British irony. The Americans on the team included Kirk Douglas, the movie's star but also its producer, Howard Fast, who wrote the novel the film was based on, and Dalton Trumbo, the screenwriter. Fast and Trumbo had been victims of the Hollywood blacklist, and the zillions lavished on a movie with their name on it marked the end of that dark chapter. Not surprisingly, they saw Spartacus as a message picture. It's the story of the slave revolt led by the gladiator Spartacus against the Roman Empire, but Fast and Trumbo have turned it into a mildly Marxist lecture on the evils of capitalism, the camaraderie of the workers, and the decadence of their owners. Leave it to the Americans to play all this stuff straight, with Douglas pouring on the rock-jawed nobility, and no one ever quite realizing how unintentionally hilarious all these brawny stars look, suffering in their togas and yelling lines like, "Hey, Spartacus, what do you think you're doing?" Listen to young Tony Curtis as the slave Antoninus when he's questioned by the evil Roman general Crassus, played by Laurence Olivier, who's just received him as a gift.
Antoninus, Sicilian, age 26, singer of songs. For whom did you practice this wondrous talent?
For the children of my master, whom I also taught the classics.
Classics, indeed. What position have we, I wonder, for a boy of such varied gifts? You shall be my body servant. Instruct him.
All of you, come with me.
Olivier is magnificent in this movie, and so are all the other British actors. They knew how to play this sort of stuff. And why wouldn't they? They had a rich tradition of British stage acting to fall back on. So, unlike the Americans, they didn't find the idea of putting on a silly costume and playing a historical figure an occasion for greater solemnity. On the contrary, they could make it fun. And so Olivier gives Crassus's villainy a lip-curling vigor that charges the whole movie. Gene Simmons makes Verinia, Spartacus's wife, at once passionate and winsomely humorous. But the best entertainment is to be had from those two old cut-ups, Peter Ustinov as a slave trader, and Charles Laughton as the Senator Gracchus. These two threw away a lot of Trumbo's sober dialogue and came up with their own, and it's great, bawdy material. Whenever they're on screen, the movie sails. It sails during its battle scenes, too, which Kubrick has directed with a Kurosawa-like splendor, and in the gladiator boot camp scenes, in which Kubrick takes an early look at what would prove to be his favorite theme, the psychosis of men at war, men isolated from women. Spartacus is too goofy to be a great movie, but see it anyway. It's probably the most beguiling curiosity in town.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For most of us, the closest we get to nature is our own backyard. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer Michael Pollan about the relationship Americans have with their lawns, their gardens, and their dreams. I'm Frank Browning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Beyond Numeracy. And Michael McCann offers some caution and some safety tips for artists. He's the director of the Center for Safety in the Arts. That's Radio Times, Monday between 10 and 12, here on 91 FM, WHYY FM in Philadelphia.
Boy, Bush says we'll stay in northern Iraq.